Let's start. So how are you guys holding up? Permanent damage or only partial? No problem. Okay, good. So any questions about yesterday? Okay, so we are on our way of towards understanding the structure of the Hilbert space of conformal field theories to then use consistency conditions like unitarity and something called crossing symmetry that I will explain physically what it is later when we get to it, to essentially be able to completely solve for, in principle, all correlation functions for an infinite class of two-dimensional conformal field theories that, in fact, are known to be in one-to-one correspondence with the critical behavior of statistical mechanics models in two dimensions. And they describe the critical exponents of those theories. And we will work out few examples of a specific conformal field theories in these families, and we'll describe the lattice Hamiltonian that has a critical point described by that conformal field theory. But that still will take a couple of lectures. First, we have to finish our understanding of the Hilbert space of two-dimensional conformal field theories, because that will this will tell us how states in the Hilbert space are packaged into representations, and then we'll continue. So yesterday I finished by describing up to one small subtlety that can be cleaned up by using what I'll do in this lecture, the most general transformation that the stress tensor can have under a conformal transformation. And we saw that there is one extra parameter that you can add that we call the central charge. And now, essentially, what I want to do is to show you that from the transformation properties of the stress tensor and the conformal transformations, we can derive the conformal algebra, which is called the Virasoro algebra in two dimensions, under which all states in the theory will fall into representations of. Okay. So, but now I want to go more from. I want to go more to the operator or Hilbert space interpretation of the theory. So remember that when you have a quantum field theory, you can think more from a path integral point of view, or you can think more from a Hamiltonian point of view, where you have space of states and you evolve with some Hamiltonian. And I want to show you a very useful choice of Hamiltonian in two-dimensional conformal field theories to study how correlation functions that we studied, say, from the path integral point of view, are related in the operator formalism. So first, let's recall a couple of quick things about quantization in Lorentzian theories. So imagine, just for simplicity, because it's easier to draw, we are in two dimensional Minkowski space. So this will be time and this will be space. Usually when we quantize a theory, we have to specify an initial value surface on which we prepare a state, and then we evolve it with some Hamiltonian in time. The usual choice that we make of initial value surface in field theory is that we choose initial value surface or, in one language, is the initial state, where we prepare the initial state, say, by choosing the surface where x0 equals 0, OK? So here, we specify a state. This should be well known, but if it's not, I can elaborate more. And if I'm going too slow, then you can make me accelerate. That's not a problem. That's never a problem. And then you evolve that state forward in time, evolve with a Hamiltonian, right? OK. You want to make me draw it again? Okay. So you want time here? I guess that's more standard. I don't have to draw this very carefully, but just. Is the physics at least clear that you have to specify initial state at some time and then evolve it with the Hamiltonian? Now we will see that in two-dimensional Euclidean signatures, there is a very interesting choice of quantization of initial value surface that we will use because it will allow us to use the power of complex analysis. But before we go there, can someone guess what other very natural choice of initial value surface you could use in a Lorentzian theory?
Something along Flatschrodinger.
Right? So you could say that I specify my initial state. So you have two light cones. Going at x plus and x minus. And now you could choose to evolve your physical system with respect to light cone time. So here you would start with some state and evolve it with time with the, in this case, the light cone Hamiltonian. Okay. So here the initial state, so this would be kind of in a light, this is called light cone quantization. This has many interesting applications in field theory, string theory. In this case, the initial state is specified by the some initial value hypersurface x plus equals zero, and then you evolve with the light cone Hamiltonian. Okay. Each choice of quantization makes manifest different symmetries of the theory, and depending on the problem, it might be more useful to use one or the other. The physics should not depend on your choice of initial value surface, what you choose to evolve things with. So in particular, if you're trying to compute the S-matrix, it shouldn't matter whether you choose one or the other. Is this very simple thing? I mean, this should be really something that you know, but I just want to make sure that everyone is happy. So now we're doing two-dimensional theories in Euclidean space. So now we have coordinates x1 and x2. And here I could have chosen, if I wanted, the most trivial extension of this kind of temporal quantization would be to choose, say, x1 or x2 as my initial value surface, and then evolve with respect to the Hamiltonian conjugate to that coordinate. But what turns out to be very useful, and this is true in any dimension, but in two dimensions, it's particularly simple to draw, is to choose the surfaces of constant time in quotes, because there is no time here, to be surfaces of constant radius. So this is just some surface of constant radius, R, okay? So this is surface, say, of some, on which the Hamiltonian acts, okay? And again, Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian conjugate to the surface. Okay? So essentially, you prepare a state at some sphere. Okay, so in two-dimensional scale, it's just a circle, right? You have a fixed circle, and then you evolve it by evolving the radius of the circle. So moving in time is like moving in the radial direction. If you were in higher dimensions, it's identical. You would have to replace the circle by a sphere, by the corresponding d minus one dimensional sphere, okay? And this kind of quantization, which was invented like many good things in physics by Dirac, it's called radial quantization for obvious reasons. Because the evolution of the system is radial in time, is radial, in the radial direction. and this was invented by Dirac. Okay. Notice that there is a way to develop some nice intuition about what's happening here by recalling an exercise that you did yesterday, hopefully, in the tutorial, which is what I'll show now is that the choice of Hamiltonian that propagates the surface, the initial state radially, is equivalent to the Hamiltonian in a different conformal frame. So yesterday you showed that you can conformally map the complex plane into a cylinder. So here is with some coordinates. I have the complex plane with coordinate z, and here we have a cylinder with some periodic coordinate sigma 1 and one non-compact coordinate sigma 0. You should think of motion in sigma 0 evolving this way is like time. Okay. Yes.
So going in the radial direction, is that dilations, dilatation?
We'll come to that in a second. Yeah. So in this picture, clearly time evolution is motion in sigma 0. Okay. In fact, we were in Lorentz in sigma. Okay. Let me not make that comment. Just that the cylinder, so this is the cylinder, you can define the cylinder in Lorentzian signature in arbitrary dimensions. This is the geometry in Lorentzian signature where the conformal group naturally acts. So remember that in the case of the Euclidean space, we had to compactify Euclidean space by adding a point at infinity because conformal transformations map a regular point at infinity. If you do it in Lorentzian signature, the natural space where the conformal group acts smoothly by adding light, okay, in that case you don't add a point, you light a light cone at infinity, is by going to the Lorentzian cylinder. Now I take the Lorentzian cylinder and I'll let it continue to the Euclidean cylinder. But this is the coordinate that you obtain by analytically continue the time coordinate. Okay. So here it's clear what's happening. You start with some state. Okay, so now let me not get there. And the conformal transformation from one to the other, can someone tell me what it is? Yes.
Euclidean space.
Yes.
You make the time periodic. So I mean, you make the time imaginary, and then you can think of it as having some period or whatever.
That's when you're not trying a temperature. The time is periodic, but no, we're not trying a temperature. Okay. So can someone tell me what the conformal transformation from the plane to the cylinder is?
E to the power of sigma zero plus I sigma.
Good. Yes. So the conformal map. So now we can start developing some intuition. I can go faster than that because you guys did that yesterday. So now let's make a table. So here is the cylinder. And this is the plane geometry. And we want to map interesting objects on one side to interesting objects on the other. So here you have the past, the infinite past, where you would have an in-state. So when you do a scattering experiment, you prepare an in-state at minus infinity, you evolve it, and it ends up overlapping with an out-state. So in the infinite path, you have a state here. You have some in-state here. Under this conformal transformation, where does the in-state go in the plane? Sorry, I'm a bit deaf, so maybe you said it. Origin, beautiful. So this is also our intuition. You prepare a state at the origin. And an out state is at infinity. So here you would have, so here is the origin. In the infinite future, you have an out state that will go to infinity in the plane or in the North Pole if you're thinking about the Riemann sphere. So let me say maybe North infinity in quotes. Okay. Here, what are the, so when you evolve the state here from minus infinity to plus infinity, you can ask what is the constant time slice? So if I have a state, I look at the fixed time. That's where you measure the state. Where does this fixed time, what does it map to into the complex plane? Circle, very good. Going this way, anti-clockwise, I think, with the sign of choice. And finally, if I want to do, first of all, okay, let me do it. If I do a time reversal, which means mapping sigma zero to minus sigma zero, this corresponds to what? To inversion. So tau, I guess, no, so not tau. So sigma zero going to minus sigma zero corresponds to inversion. And finally, the Hamiltonian in the cylinder picture, so it's called H-sil, which propagates you up the cylinder corresponds to, as we discussed, as someone said already before, to dilatations. So, I mean, this should be clear. If I map sigma zero to sigma zero plus a constant, that's what time translations do, what the Hamiltonian does, generates a time translation. This, under this conformal map, maps z to e to the a z and z bar to e to the a z bar. This is the action of L0. This is the action of L0 bar. So the Hamiltonian in the cylinder, sorry, maps to L0 plus L0 bar. But as we showed already in the last lecture, this is exactly the dilatation, okay? D. And that is one way of understanding why in conformal field theories we're interested in diagonalizing the dilatation operator. The dilatation operator is nothing but the Hamiltonian of the theory on the cylinder, okay? Is this clear? We will see that quantizing the theory in radial quantization will be very useful. Okay, so then in the another thing that I want to remind you from, well, I don't know if this is a reminder or new, but at least I hope the first part was more of a reminder than new. So usually in quantum field theory, in the operator formalism, what are the type of correlation functions that we study in the operator formalism? So if I give you a set of, so if you, okay, let me say it another way. So if in the path integral language, I have a correlation function of operators O1 at X1 to ON XN. How do you think of them in the operator approach or Hamiltonian approach or canonical approach? What is that? Is the product of the time order product? The expectation value, the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of operators. So this is the expectation value of time ordered and this is a direct consequence of the relation between the path integral and the Hamiltonian picture. which I remind you just briefly. I mean, you can derive this, and I'm sure you've derived it in class, but it's a consequence of this important formula that says that if you start with some initial state, phi of x, at t specified at some initial value surface, so at x, x is a special position, and you look at the matrix element, you evolve it in time with a Hamiltonian conjugate to the initial value surface to some out state at time t. Remember that this guy is precisely represented in a path integral line, which is the integral over all fields. Of the exponential of minus the action associated to this Hamiltonian with the boundary condition that phi, the field at zero x is phi I x, and the field at time t is specified by this state. Okay? So by using this, I mean, I'm sure you've seen in this class, if I now decide to insert here a few operators, and you use this formula over and over again by inserting complete sets of states, you go from the product of operators to, in the path integral language, to the time order product of operators in the canonical language. Okay? So in our case, since we're doing radial quantization, all our operators in the correlation function will have to be radially ordered. So from this picture, it is clear that if you have a set of operators, one comes earlier, then the next one, and so on and so on and so forth. The operator which comes the last is to the left, and the operator that comes first is to the right, because that's how time evolves in this direction. So if we, but let me just write explicitly once, just for fun. It's not fun, but I have to do it. So I have the radial, or this symbol R, now it's radial ordering, has exactly the same meaning as time ordering does in the usual Hamiltonian quantization, but now in radial quantization. And this is just the symbol that tells us that this is phi 1, phi 2, z, if z is after w, and the other way around, if w is before z. That's just a statement that, depending on where the operator is supported, you have to order them according to how far they are from the origin. Okay. Was this clear? Was this too slow? Should I accelerate or not? Okay, some people say yes. That's good. Okay, so now what we want to do is to extract the Virasoro algebra. From the conserved charges, okay? So let me remind you how this went. So we had a conserved current, J mu equals zero, and then we associated a charge by integrating the current at some fixed time surface, okay? And this fixed time surface is up to you if you're doing canonical, light cone, or radial quantization. Of course, we're gonna be doing a radial quantization. So in this case, if you want to determine the charge associated to a conserved current in radial quantization, the integral that I'll have to take, say if we're in two dimensions, would clearly be an integral along a fixed radial surface, which means it's a contour integral. I have to integrate over the fixed time surface, which is a circle, the current, okay? And that's why we use it, because then this is exactly a contour integral. So in radial quantization, the charge associated to a current will be some contour integral, okay, where you integrate over some fixed circle. And I use the convention, not to keep writing 2 pi I all over the place, that this guy includes 1 over 2 pi I, so that we can use Cauchy's formula, okay? So now let's write down the charge, conserved charge associated with conformal transformations. So first I have to tell you what the current is. The current is a holomorphic current. So now, as usual, I'm ignoring the anti-holomorphic side that just comes along for the right. And all I have to do is take our holomorphic. Remember that the stress tensor we showed that in two dimensions is a holomorphic object. And if I want to find the charge that generates a conformal transformation associated with a that is parametrized by this function epsilon of z, that tells you what the infinitesimal transformation is. This general discussion will tell us that the charge associated to epsilon that generates this transformation is the contour integral of dz, dz epsilon z. Okay. And we will now do 2 things. We will use the following fact to derive the Virasoro algebra. So the next fact I want to use is the fact that symmetry transformations acting on operators are generated by the charge conjugate to that symmetry. So the associated charge. So these are formulas that we've seen before. So if I have some field phi, and I want to represent how it transforms under some particular symmetry generator, that's given, as we've seen before, by the commutator of the charge associated to the transformation times the field. And to be precise, this, like all commutators in canonical quantization, the commutators are equal time commutators, okay? Yes. Epsilon z is the infinitesimal conformal transformation. Z goes to Z plus epsilon Z. So for each conformal transformation, infinitesimal conformal transformation parameterized by epsilon Z.
So why can we write J like that?
Okay. You wanna know why this is a conserved curve?
No, I thought okay, let's see.
Good. So here we have to compute the equal time commutator of the charge with the field. So now let's define this carefully. And this will be defined as a limiting procedure. Sorry. So that object, okay, let me write it again here. So is going to be the limit as delta goes to zero of the contour integral. Okay, let me write it and then I'll explain. In a contour where the location of the stress tensor is after, sorry, I think I'm calling it. So in pictures, what I'm doing here is I have here the W at some point in the complex plane. And now this first contour is an integral where I go slightly above the location of phi, okay? And then minus a similar integral, but now where the contour integral is slightly before the location of the operator. And this contour, so I have minus, I have this contour integral, minus this contour integral. So now I have W. Another point is that this guy so this line is the contour integral for the for Z, right? So I have some contour here, C1, C2. This is C1, this is C2, okay? But now I can write, this is the integrand is the same. Remember that all operators, when you write them down, the product of operators in the Hamiltonian picture, they're always radially ordered. So I could keep track of radially ordered everywhere. Most people, including myself, drop that. But operators are obviously radially ordered. So now if I have the integral over the same integrand in the, evaluated at two different contours, this one and this one, but now I can just reduce the difference of these contours to a contour integral around W, okay? Because, do you have some color? Because these pieces of the contour cancel between this contour and this contour, right? And all that I'll have left is a contour integral that I'll call CW, where CW encircles the location of phi, okay? So I mapped the computation of the variation of phi with respect to some transformation to a contour integral around the location of the operator of the corresponding conserved current, conserved charge. Was the gymnastics clear? Yes, okay. So now, let's apply this to this formula to a primary. Just to anticipate where this is going, what this is telling us is that the singularities, because this contour integral will be non-zero if you have some singularity, like a pole. So what this formula is telling is that the information about the product, so the operator product expansion of two fields, in this case, the stress tensor with the operator, the singular terms in the operator product expansion are uniquely determined by the transformation properties of that field. Okay, so this immediately will tell us the kind of singularities that can appear in the product of the stress tensor, or in general, a conserved current with the field. And now we will precisely fish out what the singularities for a primary operator are. Okay. So from the last lecture, we know the formula for this, for a primary field, right? It has the usual two terms. It has the W translation part, and then we have the piece that comes from the Jacobian that tells us the fact that phi is a tensor with a scaling weight h times phi. Okay. So from equating these two things, we will be able to determine the singularities in the product of TZ with phi W. Okay. So how would you do that? I mean, can someone tell me how you would do that?
Like in small distance in, between Z and W, and say that like T of Z is T of W plus derivative up. No, we want to obtain derivative of phi, so we obtain phi of Z plus derivative of phi at point Z.
Well, I think what you're saying is that, well, first of all, what kind of, what is the singularity structure? Okay, I already told you the answer. What is the kind of singularity structure that the product of T with phi will have to have in order to give you this?
One simple pole and one double pole.
Yes. So let's see this a bit more explicitly. I mean, if you have a contour integral of something that doesn't have a pole, it will vanish. So we need a pole. So now I'll remind you of, I think it's called Cauchy's theorem. Or, Cauchy's formula, I don't know. So this is the statement that you have a contour integral around some point, say z0, of some function fz times a denominator that has the pole of degree n plus 1 at zero, at the around the points at 0. This gives us 1 over n factorial, right? Times the nth derivative of this function evaluated at the pole, otherwise known as the residue. Okay? So now putting these things together, can someone tell me which kind of terms I have to write here on the right hand side to reproduce this? Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time over this, but otherwise, I don't want to. Okay, so let me write it down, and then you will see. So this guy has one derivative of epsilon, right? So we will have to have a double pole there. The term, this term will have to have a double pole. And, sorry, middle. No, it's fine, yes. So this guy has one derivative, has to have a double pole. This guy has no derivative, so it's a simple pole. So this will be plus terms that we can extract from here, which are plus regular terms. So all the singular terms are completely specified. Regular terms means that they have no singularity as z approaches w. Okay. So from this logic, we have been able to extract already a very useful information about the OPE. Okay, so OPE, and this is something that will come back over and over again. This is the basic ingredient that will allow us to solve conformal for the correlation function of conformal field theory in two dimensions, in higher dimensions. In principle, it would, but it's too hard. In two dimensions, the reason we can do it is because we have much more symmetry. As we will see, that the symmetry will be infinite dimensional. So this is the operator product expansion. So essentially what this formula is telling us is that, so let me just remind you very quickly, and we'll come back to this, of course, much more later. The operator product expansion is essentially like a Taylor series for operators. This is something that you do is that when you have two operators, and you want to study what happens when these operators approach each other, okay? And the thing that happens is that you can replace, if you look from far away, you wouldn't be able to tell that whether there is, so if I go to Kitchener, you wouldn't be able to tell that there are two points here. You would see that there is some blob. So the OPE essentially allows you to replace the product of these two operators by a sum of a local operators, okay? So you describe this by saying that so you replace this, you expand it, like in a Taylor series, with an infinite number of operators of this type, okay? Now these coefficients are completely fixed by conformal invariants, because the left-hand side has to transform the same as the right-hand side under conformal transformations. So just dilatation, rotational, and translational invariance tells us that the Cijk z minus w as a function of z minus w is some structural constants, the ijk, which are constants, and will have tons of information for us, times z minus w. And now we have to think for 1 second. So this guy has to have the same dimension and spin on both sides. So this means that this is hk. Can people see? Maybe they cannot see. I don't know. Hi minus hj. OK? And every conformal field theory comes associated with certain basic DNA. And the basic DNA is the spectrum of those guys and these structure constants. And as we will see, by using consistency conditions of how you have multiple operators, how can you do OPEs in different orders, mathematically saying that the operator product expansion is associative. It doesn't matter whether I multiply, you have three operators, or 1, 2, 3. It doesn't matter whether I do first 2, 3, and then 1, or 1, 2, and then 3. By imposing that the correlators are associative, we'll be able to determine not only these structural constants, but also the exact dimensions of every operator. Okay? This just to give you a flavor why we're doing these gymnastics. Okay, so this is the singularity structure. So this is a particular OPE of one of the central objects in conformal field theory, which is the holomorphic stress tensor with a primary operator. We have completely fixed its singularity structure. Now, in general, can someone guess what would happen if phi was not a primary operator? What would change?
Thank you.
in particular, a descendant, right? The order of? That's right. Yes, exactly. Precisely. Because the whole point of a non-primary operator is that these are operators that are sensitive to transformations that are not the global conformal transformations. These are the ones that are for which the third derivative of epsilon is non-trivial, okay? And in order to get the third derivative of epsilon, here it's clear that you will need a higher order pole just using the Cauchy formula. So in general, the OPE of the stress tensor with any operator, which is not primary, so how should I call it? Bar phi. Well, if this guy has well-defined scaling dimension, it will be, will have, of course, this piece. But the point I want to emphasize is that it can have higher poles. And now we will study a particular example of an operator that's not a primary operator, that is also one of our best friends, which is the stress tensor. Yes?
Is something we assume or we do?
In the original work where this was done, it's an assumption. You assume that, but it's a very physically reasonable assumption. You multiply to three operators, it doesn't matter in which order. And this condition is exactly the, I mean, sometimes it's called the conformal bootstrap. It's a statement that you have a correlation function of an operator. It shouldn't matter in which order you fuse the operator. And this condition alone gives you enough equation. So this gives you a lot of very complicated, naively very complicated, well, not naively, a very complicated looking equation. But smart people know how to solve it. And we will be smart enough to solve it.
Question?
Yes.
So can you have types of some operators that will give you essential singularities? Or is it just poles?
All that you can have is poles? Okay, there are more sophisticated things that we may discuss later when we discuss the serializing model. Sometimes there are special operators that are called non-local sometimes that can give you branch cards. I've never seen an operator that gives you the essential singularity, but you can definitely have branch cards. It would be operators that have the property that if you move one operator around the other, it changes sign. And that's exactly what happens with Fermi. We will see that. But. So now let's use this logic to determine, want to determine the OPE of the stress tensor with itself, right? And remember from the last lecture that I argued, just based on dimensional analysis, that the most general conformal transformation of the stress tensor has the obvious primary piece, quasi-primary piece, but that dimensional analysis and blah, 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 locality and so on, allow me to write this extra piece. That is the third derivative of the conformal vector field. And now we can use this general prescription to just extract the different terms of the OPE that will give us this guy. Well, this guy and this guy we already know, right? That's exactly what we already computed. This gives me a double pole and a simple pole. This guy will have to give you a fourth order pole because I have three derivatives. And that's what Mr. Cauchy says. So then we get that TZ, TW has a fourth order pole. The coefficient of the fourth order pole is this infamous central charge that I'll give some physics for very soon. And then we have the part that just tells us that the stress tensor is a quasi-primary tensor that has dimension 2. And this part just tells us that the kinematical part of the transformation, so that it transforms by the derivative, plus regular, OK? Are people happy with this? I should put a square, I guess. It's an important formula. Now, yesterday, there was a loophole in the derivation, in the argument that this was the most general conformal transformation that the stress tensor could have. And now I don't want to prove it here. I want you to try. It's kind of a simple, but you have to be careful in carrying out the argument, the logical argument. So here, a priori, you could have had a term. Naively, you could say, why can't I write a term that has a third order pole here? Okay. And now what I want you to try to prove is to show that if you demand that the OPE, so one thing to say is that the order of the operators here doesn't matter, okay? So if you demand that this equation, essentially I'm saying that this is a consequence of the statement that it shouldn't matter in what order I put the operators, okay? You should be able to see that the cubic term here is ruled out, roughly speaking, because it's odd under z minus w. If I exchange z and w, z minus w cubed goes to minus zw cubed. So you could say, okay, that's a trivial way of killing it. But essentially that's what happens. But I want you to understand why this argument fails for this guy. This guy is also odd under z minus w. And what I want you to prove is how, from this formula, the fact that this term should be invariant under z minus w arises. And the hint is that when you compare the OPE, this OPE with this OPE, you will have to re-expand a higher order term around the same point. Okay, and this will generate a higher order pole and everything will work out. So give it a try. It's just a small detail, but I think it will test whether you understand exactly what's happening. Yes?
So analysis.
No, because I
said that would have cubic, then would be somehow square root of t or something like that.
No, because I could have written here another operator. Say there's an operator of dimension 1 in the conformal field theory. But this argument proved that there is no such term can ever arise. And the thing that's very important also in the argument, just to give you one more hint, is that the operator, of course, that appears here is which operator? The identity. Okay. And the identity has an important fact that it doesn't transform under a shift. The identity here is the same identity there. While this guy, if you evaluate it, if you shift it, it will transform. And we'll combine this guy to make this happen. Okay. So if someone is feeling bored and wants a challenge, they can try to prove it. Excellent. So now I want to give you a couple of quick physical interpretations for the central charge. So there are several. At least I want to show you where it arises. Okay. So one place that it arises in an immediate form is, let's just compute this in a vacuum expectation value. What will I get just from the knowledge of the OPE? What will I get on the right-hand side? Well, from the knowledge of the OPE and some knowledge that you gathered in the last week. I hope you have gathered in the last week. It's not a trick question. It should be really simple. What did we say the vacuum expectation value of a non-identity operator was? Yes. Yes, but why?
Because all the other vanish.
Remember that we proved that the one-point function of any operator that is not the identity vanishes. So the only term that contributes when I compute the vacuum expectation value is the identity contribution. Okay. So this is something that I mentioned already before, that I had mentioned even in higher dimensions, that the central charge, the central charge of the CFT is measured by the two-point function of the stress tensor in flat space. You can also measure it by coupling it to curved space and look at the one-point function, but let's ignore that for a second. Should I give you this example? Yeah, another example I want to give you is, so there are many things you want to say about the central charge. Let me just say a couple more. C, I already mentioned it at some point, is a measure of the number of degrees of freedom. The theory. This is a statement that there is a function C that you can define even away from fixed points. So at the conformal point, you have a function C mu that at the fixed point exactly coincides with the C that appears here. But you can construct a function C mu. That's mu is the energy scale under RG flow, so flowing towards infrared. That is a function that decreases monotonically towards infrared. Okay. And this is very nice because this fits exactly the intuition that this guy measures the number of degrees of freedom. So whenever you start with a theory and you flow from the UV to the infrared, physically what's happening is that as you go to larger and larger distances, you lose degrees of freedom because there are very heavy states that the theory may have had originally that you have no way of exciting at very large distances because the energy that you have available is much smaller. And Zamolodchikov constructed precisely such a function. And if I have time late next week, I will prove this because I think it's an important result of quantum field theory in general, C theorem. He constructed a function that has exactly these heuristic properties that we want, which is exactly towards infrared. And it exactly coincides with when you hit a fixed point. So you go from one ultraviolet fixed point to some infrared fixed point. The function at the fixed point exactly is the one that would be captured by the two-point function of the stress tensor. And in particular, this statement implies, as a corollary, that the UV central charge is always bigger than the infrared central charge. And that's why it has this physical notion as measuring the number of degrees of freedom, okay? Another fun application, so if there are people interested in condensed matter or quantum information, whatever, there's another place where the central charge appears in a physical observable. So let me just mention this briefly, because I think it's a nice application. And if we had time, I think it is one of the statement I'm going to make now is a statement that given the tools that you will have by the end of the course, it would be, if you worked for a couple of weeks on it, you would be able to prove this statement. But let me tell you what the physics around the statement is. Another place where the central charge appears is in So remember that at the beginning of the course, I mentioned that conformal field theories appear in describing the quantum phase transitions in a one-dimensional, okay, for two-dimensional conformal field theories. We had that two-dimensional CFTs describe the quantum critical points of one-dimensional quantum spin chains. Like the Heisenberg spin chain or the Ising, quantumizing spin chain. And one place where this C appears is the following. So there is one nice observable that you can define in any quantum field theory, which is called entanglement entropy. Have people heard this word before? Yes? Okay. So this is the statement is that if you have, so I'm drawing the picture in higher dimensions because in two dimensions, in some sense, I mean, in one dimension, the entanglement entropy is kind of a bit of a boring object, but geometrically, I mean. You take a region in space, and you divide it into two pieces, say A and B, okay? And you want to study the von Neumann entropy associated to the density matrix rho. So psi is some, say, pure state. Okay? And now you want to first, let's first decide what is the entropy associated to a pure state. So what is the entropy associated to a pure state? Zero, okay? There is no uncertainty in a pure state. You know everything about it. You can define something interesting, which is the density matrix associated to the region A by essentially tracing out. So the Hilbert space of the theory has a Hilbert space associated to region A and to region B. And what you do is you take the trace. You trace out all the degrees of freedom that are associated to region B. And you define this reduced density matrix, where you have traced over all states in the Hilbert space associated to region B. And then people are interested. And if you want to know why, you should ask Giffre. But people are sometimes interested in computing the von Neumann entropy associated to this. OK, and this is called entanglement entropy associated to region A. OK, there are more things I could say, but let me not say them. So essentially, the thing I want to say is that it can be shown using fairly, essentially tools that we have used in the course and we will use in the course. It can be shown that if you study this problem for a one-dimensional quantum spin chain, so you have a quantum spin chain, so its x here is some spin, and you want to denote some region A here that has some length L. So this would be the region A, and region B is the complement. And you study the behavior of this observable near the critical point. So if the spin chain has a critical at the critical point, this entanglement entropy scales. So as a general rule, it scales like the area of the region into the in one dimension is kind of degenerate, so it goes logarithmically. But the main point I want to tell you is that the behavior of the entanglement entropy at the critical point is controlled by exactly the central charge. Okay. So again, this also gives you the intuition that the central charge is a statement about the number of states in the system, because it appears in this observable in the entanglement entropy. And one last quick application, or maybe I should leave that. Let me just say it quickly, not bothering about the derivation. Maybe you can, that's something that maybe we can put in a tutorial next week. Is the statement that also the central charge controls the Casimir energy of a system in finite volume. So imagine we do again this. A way to convince yourself is take the plane, conformally map it to a cylinder, okay? And now I'll put some dimensionful scale, some cylinder that has one periodic coordinate. So you have W1, I call it now W1 and W2, where W2 has periodicity, the circle has periodicity 2 pi L, okay? Now what I want to say is that now, of course, you can compute what is the value of the stress tensor in the cylinder frame. That will be obtained from the stress tensor that we've been talking about in the plane by a conformal transformation, right? So you would obtain that by doing dz dw square dz. The dz is the one in the plane, plus, I didn't write it down, but you know, there was this funny Schwarzian term, this Schwarzian derivative business, that precisely measures by how much the operator is not primary. And then essentially, what I leave you to show is that the stress tensor in the cylinder, just doing this computation and using the formula that we wrote before for the conformal map from the plane to the cylinder, you find that the stress tensor of the cylinder is 2 pi over L square. The one in the plane, okay, so let me be explicit, right? The one in the plane, T of Z times Z square. And now the point is that the Schwarzian derivative is non-trivial. So you'll get minus C over 24 times this. This is just a statement that this transformation is not global. So the Schwarzian derivative piece is non-zero. And now from here, what we can see is that if I want to compute the vacuum expectation value in the cylinder, this guy is zero, right? From the same argument as before, the expectation value of the stress tensor in the plane is zero. But now you get a contribution which is proportional to precisely the central charge, okay? And this is a statement that if you have a system at finite volume, the quantum fluctuations of the system give you some energy, which is the Casimir energy. OK. Good. So I've given you here three different places. And there are many others. I mean, it's really an important and kind of basic object in CFT of the central charge. It measures the number of degrees of freedom. It decreases under normalization group flow. We've shown that it describes entanglement entropy near quantum critical points. And it measures the Casimir energy when you study a system at finite volume. And it knows about the quantum fluctuations of the system at finite volume. Very good. But I should, I guess, move forward. Any questions about this? So now what I want to do is go back to this formula and derive from it the, so first of all, let's calculate the conformal algebra from that commutator, from that OP, sorry. So the first thing I'll do is take the stress tensor, the holomorphic stress tensor, and do a kind of a Fourier, if I was in the cylinder, but in this case with a Laurent expansion in terms of some modes, okay? This is like some Fourier modes. Ln, these will be called the Virasoro generators. If you wish, what I'm doing is that I'm I'm again doing a Laurent expansion of this epsilon z. Epsilon z was a conformal transformation, and we remember that we classified it, and you can make a Laurent expansion. So Ln is a conformal transformation associated to a particular term in the Laurent expansion. Okay. Now I can invert this relation using the contour integral, and write this as the contour integral dz. I have to pick the pole here, so I multiply by z n plus 1 dz. Okay. And now what I want to calculate is the commutator. So maybe I will not do all the details in front of you. You can try to do it we'll put it in a tutorial. So now all that I do is replace ln and lm. I represent it as a contour integral of the stress tensor. So now I have a double contour integral dw with contour c0, an integral dz around cw. So I have here c0 and this is the cw, okay, of dz dw. I just plug in this expression, right? Z n plus 1 w m plus 1. So let me just sketch how to do this. Not writing all the, I'm not sure it's going to be illuminating to write all the formulas in the blackboard. All that now you have to do is plug in the form of the OPE that we just derived of dz with tw in terms of the central charge and the stress tensor and its derivatives. Maybe I'll show you one step, no, two steps, and then I'll leave the last one for you. So this guy in bracket, I can just substitute with the formula there. So I have c over 2 z minus w to the fourth plus 2 tw z minus w square plus the derivative of the stress tensor z minus w. Okay. And now all I do is re-expand again tw in terms of these Laurent generators. So let's first do the integral over z. So we're left of the integral over w. So we have w to the n plus 1. And now all I really have to do is use the Cauchy formula. So from the identity term, I have to take the third derivative of that. So that gives me 1 12 c n plus 1 n minus 1 w n minus 2. This comes from the third derivative. I have to take three derivatives of the argument plus 2 n plus 1 w n tw plus w n plus 1 the derivative of the stress tensor. Okay. So now all that I'm left with is the integral over this last variable w, and that's the part I will leave to you. It's all that now you would really have to do is use the Laurent decomposition, the fact that t has a Laurent series representation in terms of the Virasoro generators. So doing these integrals is line by line exactly what I did here. Is exactly the same. So try to do it and you will get the Virasoro algebra. That tells us that the commutator of ln with lm has the piece that we already understood by just studying classical vector fields. Yes.
And the lm with these two integrals, like
We can
that's what I did there, right?
Do we have commutator of t inside?
This is exactly the derivation I did there. I said that the equal time commutator of two operators was the contour integral of the OP of the operators. In that blackboard, the right. So all I'm doing now is that I'm integrating the location of one operator over some contour. But the fact that on the right-hand side you get the OP of the operator is exactly that derivation over there. Do you see what I'm pointing? You're not pointing the right
way. Yeah, I see, but I don't see the connection. Like,
no, yeah. The connection is, okay, let's see. Oh, I forgot to do something, actually, I realized.
Where is the
right, the best place to look at it? Oh, I think I missed it. No, it's here, sorry. So this was this derivation here, right? The commutator was given by this, and this was given by a contour integral like that. And now all that I'm doing is that integrating this guy further over W, that's it.
But then we will obtain two difference of
the commutator
double integrals.
Think of phi as t.
Okay.
In particular, phi is just t, and just plug it into this formula.
Shouldn't you have some center of charge in your previous
round? Oh, yeah, sure. I didn't finish the sentence.
Oh,
yeah, so I was saying that this part you know a lot because that's the one we derived just from analysis of classical geometry direction. Yes.
Yeah, but maybe just to make the commutator a bit clearer, what is the, you have drawn two contour integrals there. So CW goes around W.
Yeah.
Right. And C0, what is the point in the middle?
Okay.
C0 is supposed to the inner curve.
Sorry?
I mean, C0 refers to the inner curve.
C0 is this?
Not the point. Yeah.
No, C0 is the contour.
Yeah.
So the point in the middle is W.
Yeah. I think it's better that maybe try to do it.
The argument is this: to write in this way, it is guaranteed that for every W, every point of W, it is enclosed by a contour of Z. The contour of Z is always enclosed. Circles around the point of any W.
Yeah.
That relation is guaranteed.
Yeah.
So
you're saying W or not W?
No, I mean when the point of W is fixed, the point is always closed by the contour of A. So it corresponds to that commutator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether this answers your question.
Okay, I don't know if that's that.
Maybe you should repeat that.
I think it would be more educational that people try to. So, were people happy with that derivation or not? I mean, if they were happy with this one, just try. Drawing the contours for this particular computer, and if you're not happy by Monday, we'll go through it carefully. I would rather move to some new material. Okay, so here we have this. And then what we find is this extra term. So now we see that the original, the weight algebra, is the form. Okay, so the name of this algebra is called the Virasoro algebra. It has this extra term that is controlled by the central charge. And what can I say about this? So some things to say about is that for the global transformation, so remember, these are the ones that were generated by L minus 1, L0, and L1. The algebra is undeformed. This is just a statement that the right-hand side, I mean, this term vanishes for n equals 0, 1, and minus 1, OK? And that is not very surprising because C only knows it appears in the transformations when you do a non-global transformation. Okay, so for the global transformations, the anomaly term just vanishes. Okay. Good. So the next step, but I don't have time now to do it. I'll start next week, Monday. The next step will be to study in detail the representations of the Virasoro algebra. The states of the theory will have to fall into representations of the Virasoro algebra. And then we'll see what constraints unitarity gives us. But I think something I should mention is that, so today I think you'll get some homework. And in order to maybe be more clear, there's one extra thing I want to say about, I want to add to the lecture so that the homework is more completely clear, it's more self-contained. So let's see. So, no, which blackboard I want to raise? I think I can erase this one. Yes. I want to give you an operator derivation of something that. It's quite important in field theories, which are called the word identities. These are identities that you can derive from that are usually derived from the path integral point of view, and that relate. So physically, what they relate is that the basic physical statement is that if you have a theory with a certain symmetry, it doesn't need to be a conformal symmetry; it's for any symmetry. The fact that the theory has that symmetry relates the correlation functions of a set of operators is related to the correlation function of the same set of operators with insertion of the current that generates that symmetry. Okay, so it relates an n plus one point function with insertion of one current with an n point function of the basic set of operators. So now let's try to see it from this point of view. So imagine I want to compute something like this. I'm interested in some string of operators, phi 1 to phi n. And they lie in the complex plane, somewhere like that. Okay. And now I decide to multiply these by the integral over O along some contour, which I'll specify in a second, of the charge that generates a conformal transformation associated to epsilon, okay? And where the charge of contour is such, this contour C is a contour that encircles all the points in the operators, in that string of operators, okay? So that's one equation. Now we can use contour deformation arguments to say that this integral is exactly the same by deforming the contour as integrating such that I encircle every point with a small loop around it, okay? And now we can use the fact that we can use that formula, which is hidden there. We can use this formula, that the contour integral of T essentially times the operator, where I take a small contour around the insertion of the operator, just gives me the transformation of that field under the corresponding symmetry, okay? Making a mess here with the blackboard. So this tells us that this is the same as the sum from 1 to n of phi 1 x 1 w 1 delta phi I w I delta, sorry, phi n w n. Okay? So, and notice that this guy is nothing but the variation under a conformal transformation of the original correlator of the string of operators. Okay. And this does exactly as I said. It relates the correlation function, the variation of a correlation function of n operators given a symmetry, so we know how delta acts on all the fields, to an n plus one correlation function where you insert the current into the correlator. Okay, so here I should, sorry, put that. Okay. And in the homework, you will explore some of the consequences of this. Identities, these are, as I said, they're called word identities. Okay. And these are true in any, for any theory, it doesn't have to be a CFT. Let me just write down the formula for what it would be for a general symmetry. So if you have a general symmetry, we'll have a conserved current J mu. Maybe I shouldn't do that. So okay, let me just write it down and so if you are in D dimensions, the statement is that the current, so you know that the current is conserved, right? That's a statement that it generates a conserved charge. The statement of the word identity is that inside a correlation function, the current is conserved except okay, in this integrated form is exactly the statement that I wrote there. So it's delta of phi x1, the variation of the correlator. Okay, so that's the general form of the word identity. What do you want to say now? So one thing to say is that But depending on the behavior of this integral at infinity, one of the consequences of this equation, this is an integral over total derivative. This equation, in some sense, is just telling us that if you have a symmetry, that the variation of the correlator has to vanish under that symmetry. Okay, that's something that we knew. In conformal field theory, we will see that the left-hand side of this equation will vanish for the global conformal transformations, but not for the local ones, because precisely they make a mess at infinity. So you have to worry about this argument of integration by parts. And then it gives a nice relation between OPE, correlators of a stress tensor with primaries. And I guess the last thing I should tell you is that, so here I have an integral over all space of some derivative. And in order to match this, the general word identity in any dimensions with this, what you have to use is, how is that called? The, I always forget the name, but the divergence theorem, right? The fact that the integral, a volume integral of a derivative is the same of a surface integral without the derivative. I think that's called divergence theorem. And that's exactly this. Okay? So try in the homework to extract some concept. I mean, you get hopefully enough hints of how to do all the steps. But one of the things that I want you to do is to see how a lot of information is encoded into these word identities and work them out in the simple example of conformal transformations. I'm way over time, so I stop. I'll have a good weekend.